So this is going to be a two-part talk. And to be honest, the reason is that the site I'm going to be talking about, we only worked on for a month. So I don't really have an hour's worth of things to say about it. But what I thought I would do is begin by giving you a sense of what conditions were in Iraq immediately after the U.S. invasion, because I was there. And then the bulk of our talk, my talk, will be talking about our work at Tel Sahariya. But Tel Sahariya, we were the first foreign expedition after all of the wars and occupation. But as I said before, we only spent 1 month there, and so we didn't have we don't have that much to say about it. So I want to start off by talking a little bit about the looting. I've mentioned it before. It had begun after the first Gulf War in 1990. I mean, there were occasional holes in sites before then, but before that time, basically most of the Iraqi sites were in pretty good shape. But in 1990, Saddam Hussein completed the construction of the Third River. And what the Third River actually did was take away a lot of irrigation water from a lot of peasants, which is a bad thing to do. This was partly because he knew that they didn't like him because they had done some rebellion, and partly for other reasons. So what happened was these poor peasants had another source of income, which was to dig holes in archaeological sites, which were all over the place. And so you had a real uptick in looting after the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein himself was much weaker. He didn't have nearly the policing powers he'd had before. And so large numbers of sites were looted. And I'd been tracking this using high-resolution satellite imagery. And then came the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, which kind of opened Iraq back up again to archaeologists, or actually anybody, at that particular point. I actually went in with a group from National Geographic just a few days after the war was over, and there was like one sad American at the border, and that was about it. Later on, when we went out, at one point, again, there was a sad American guy at the border saying, "Does anybody in this car speak English and Arabic?" We acknowledged that, yes, we could probably manage. We actually had a bilingual person with us. And there were a couple of Iraqis who wanted to walk across the border, and they needed somebody to tell them they couldn't do so. They had nobody who could communicate with anybody. It was really chaotic. We traveled to Iraq, and there were these various people had kind of done various things to pictures of Saddam Hussein. And so this is a National Geographic group sponsored by National Geographic, led by Henry Wright, who was a member of their kind of academic committee. So in we went, and we first visited Babylon. So it had been occupied by U.S. forces, but apart from the looting of the museum, which you can see in flames, burned, the site itself was actually in pretty good shape. It hadn't been badly damaged. It was a kind of an odd place. Saddam Hussein had built himself a palace on it. The degree to which it's actually on the site or not on the site has never been entirely clear to me. It's near the river, but I'm not sure it isn't also on the site. At this particular point, though, the palace was now occupied by U.S. forces. And so the American army were really rather... They really liked, actually, occupying Saddam's palaces. They did that quite often. And so they were there then. In addition to building his own palace there, Saddam decided to rebuild the palace of Nebuchadnezzar as well. That was another element, and again, didn't do it very well. Mostly in terms of what we were looking at, what you can look for in Babylon in terms of damage that has to do with the war, they did dig a whole bunch of foxholes kind of around the Nebuchadnezzar's palace, the reconstructed palace. I've kind of circled these in red and blue on these particular images. But those are relatively small holes in a rather large site. And they also kind of put all kinds of holes in around the theater, and there was various kinds of building up. But in many ways, the things that Saddam had done in terms of building buildings on it was much worse than anything that happened kind of later. There was a fair amount of damage that was caused between the... do I have a pointer here? I do, don't I? Let's see if I can... I see this. So things like this parking lot and things like that are some of the things which were which have been damaged. So there's a certain amount of kind of problematic stuff here and there. I mean, I think that when you add it all together, the upper picture, everything outlined in red, is essentially damaged due to the occupation of Babylon by U.S. forces in one way or another. Is it serious? Some of it is, some of it isn't. But it certainly was something that really should not have been done. It's in contravention of the Hague Convention, which includes saying, I'm going to have to page myself down here, which is always complicated. Oops. Everybody who is a signatory, which includes the Americans, should refrain from any use of property in its immediate soundings or of the appliances in use for its protection for purposes which are likely to expose it to destruction or damage in the event of armed conflict, and by refraining from any act of hostility directed against such property. A center containing monuments... I hate these things. Shall be deemed to be used for military purposes whenever it is used for the movement of military personnel or material, even in transit. So the Hague Convention is very clear. The Americans paid no attention whatsoever and occupied Babylon and did some lasting damage to it. All right. But other sites did much better. We visited the remarkably well-preserved palace at Ctesiphon. There was no obvious damage there. One kind of worries about a large arch. You can just see the beginning of the arch. I didn't include that in the picture right here, and the wall. But, you know, it seemed to be just fine. And then we headed south. And we headed south because Henry Wright, who was our team leader, and in fact, and the sponsor for all of this, he had conducted a survey in the area around Eridu, and he wanted to kind of go off and take a look at some of the sites that he had seen so many years before. Where we are right now is a site called Dahalia, which I discussed in my first lecture. It's the place where we think that it may have been that the population of Ur may have moved to, and I'll come back to Dahalia again. Now, I think one of the things that we have to understand about the looting, because, you know, we're archaeologists, we don't like looting, is just the degree to which the looting was caused by the Iraqi government. And yes, it was done by the Iraqi people, but it was really done so that they could feed their families in a situation that was really pretty dire. So I just want to reiterate that. When I was with Henry Wright, we were down in Nasiriyah in the south, and local archaeologists had persuaded the U.S. occupation forces to look at the problem of site looting. They had unusual access to the U.S. forces because the U.S. forces were occupying the museum. And so since they were in his building, he could say, hey, you know, people are looting sites all over the place. You should do something about it. You are now the police. You are now the government. You should control this. And so Henry Wright and the group that I was part of kind of wandered into Nasiriyah basically the day before the U.S. military were going to go off and look at sites. And so we could just tag along with them and take a look. And in some cases, the situations were really bad. So this is Lhasa. And Lhasa is one of the sites that has been, was very badly looted. You know, you can see all of the holes. It's going to be a mess. It's always going to be kind of hard to recover and kind of figure things out there, I think. But we didn't go over, we didn't visit very many sites. We weren't there very long. We didn't have very much logistical support. And then in May 2008, I was invited to be a member of a British museum group who were visiting Iraq, again with the idea of taking a look at the condition of sites and museums. In this particular instance, however, the British were part of the occupying forces, and the British military were putting all kinds of things in order to kind of help us out. In my first lecture, I showed this slide showing some of the sites that had been surveyed through helicopter trips after the Gulf War, and especially with a concentration in... in this area down here, in Dikar Governorate, kind of right here. And I also kind of mentioned the fact that many of the looted sites are close to the borders. But it was the Dikar sites that we were went to take a look at as a British team, kind of led by John Curtis. So this had the same basic goal as the earlier trip. But in this case, our transportation was much better. We were kind of whirled away in helicopters by the British military. And so we were able to get from site to site with much greater ease. We were able, therefore, to see a lot more sites under those circumstances. We did go back to Dhahalia again. So Dhahalia is this large early second millennium site located kind of near Eridu. We think it's probably the place where the population of Ur may have moved after some Siluna destroyed Ur. For one thing, it has a temenos. It's about the only site that we know of other than Ur that has what seems to be a walled religious area. And so that's one of the things that makes it special. The site was abandoned while they were still working on basalt. Sculptures for something or other, so there were quite a bit of kind of worked basalt that was kind of floating around the surface of that particular site. It's a site that I think is going to be very interesting to work on at some point. We also went to Eridu. Eridu was largely untouched by looters and was in pretty good shape. And the only evidence that we had of looting was the dig house. That was rather comforting. We were perfectly happy for them to loot the dig house since they weren't going to find anything other than occasional sardine cans. Lagash is one of the largest sites in Mesopotamia, and it's huge. It goes on and on. It's, I think, 4 kilometers long. Really had only seemed to suffer from erosion and neglect. We did find some meals ready to eat, which is what the poor American soldiers have given when they're in the field. So they had been there, but they had fortunately not decided against digging holes in it for protection. I don't think they can have been there for very long. Maybe they just had lunch there, I'm not sure. But we did run into those. Tel Alahim, though, is more problematic. So this is a site that has not really been excavated. You can see a couple of little looting holes over here. But what was really a problem, and I don't know which army did this, but what you've got here are positions that are dug in where you can put a tank. But I don't know whose tank it was. So I don't know whether it's an Iraqi tank or an American tank that we have to blame for this. But this did involve some significant kind of digging into the site. This was just a little introduction. an aside in a sense. So what I would say is that some sites like Lhasa are very badly damaged. Mostly it's surface damage, so that if you get below it, you're going to find good stuff. But by no means were all sites badly damaged. That's not the case everywhere. But let's move on to something more positive. So what I want to do is I want to talk about the Sealand dynasty, which is becoming increasingly understood now, but was not for a long time and was not the time that we were working there, and the site of Tel Saharia, where we had a single one-month field season. So, you know, we were thinking after the U.S. invasion of Iraq that one might be able to think about digging in Iraq again. And the question is, what did we want to do? And, you know, most archaeological work in Iraq has focused on great big cities. And we wanted to know more about small sites and their relationship with the larger urban sites. I mean, to what extent, how did they work? And then one of the complications, and to be honest, it remains a complication as far as I'm concerned, is that when they have had excavations in small sites, they look like baby cities. So Tel Hamel and Haradim have both been excavated fairly extensively. They have each have a temple. They each have an administrative building, sometimes across the street from each other. They have houses, just like the houses in the cities. And the houses in these little tiny village-sized settlements, or hamlet-sized settlements even, I mean, they're 1 hectare, they're tiny, have exactly the same tablets that you're going to find in large cities. So we're not finding what one might have expected, which would be a kind of a rural, less literate, less sophisticated population living in small settlements. I mean, in many ways, I know it more from Britain, but I'm sure you know it from France, you know, French villages are very different from Paris. And yet here we were with Mesopotamia, really have been in a situation where you couldn't really make that statement in terms of the differences between sites of very different sizes. So the question is, you know, what's going on, you know, with these smaller sites? And the answer is that even when we can begin to increase the number, they still look the same. I think you can see that in, so this is a satellite image of a site, but you can see the dense housing, the streets, it all looks very kind of urban. And here's another one where I've traced some of the material. Obviously, we can't do anything with the looted part, but I've traced some of the walls. And again, you've got the dense housing, the winding streets. So it really does look as though Harmel and Tel Haradim are, in fact, fairly typical of small sites. And we don't seem to have in Mesopotamia the kind of the village-city difference. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't all kinds of people living, weren't all kinds of people living in tents or reed huts and other kinds of settlements that were living a different lifestyle, but it looks as though if you were living in a mud brick house, your lifestyle was pretty similar no matter how large or small the settlement was that you were living in. Now, we also have, both dating to the Old Babylonian period and to the Kassite period, some sites that are somewhat more complicated to understand. This site has now been worked on to a certain extent and seems to be a kind of small kind of administrative building. I always used to think it was a temple because it seemed to have a nice rectangular structure with a square courtyard, but it isn't, which just shows you've got to be careful of how you interpret things. But what you're looking at here are some very small sites with some substantial architecture and planned architecture on them that are not villages and have public buildings on them. And so I think one of the things we need to populate are, in our mind's eye, when we think about the Mesopotamian landscape, is it's not just going to have little villages and farmers, it's going to have institutions. What those institutions are, we don't know. We haven't excavated them. But I think some of these sites would be very interesting to excavate to see what kinds of buildings were on them, and especially if they're in periods like the early second millennium where you can expect large, high degrees of literacy, if we can have kind of tablet archives coming from these small sites that tell us kind of what they were up to. The questions that we were had in our mind was, you know, we've got these sites. They don't look quite the way they should. How can we begin to understand the relationship between small sites, cities, and what their that interrelationship? And I think we were especially interested in the early second millennium BC because that's when we get the most extensive written documentation that can give us a better idea than what we can just get from the archaeological data. We headed to the Nasiriyah area. This comes from WikiLeaks that recorded all of the violent deaths in Iraq. Clearly, Baghdad wasn't a place you wanted to be. But Nasiriyah, which is a substantial town, was very, very quiet and indeed has remained very quiet to this day. And so that seemed like an obvious place to go, and the Ur area was good. And then the other thing about the Ur itself is Ur has a whole bunch of dig houses so that you have a place that you can live if you want to do some field work in the vicinity. And so there were two small sites that were of interest. One was called Mathariyah over here, and the other was called Sahariyah over here. I thought Mathariyah looked like a really neat little site. So that was my first choice. And so that was the first one we went to take a look at. Looking at the satellite image, there seemed to be all kinds of architectural. It was tiny. Somebody did seem to have done something through the middle of it, but never mind. The rest of it was OK. And it had a checkpoint right next door to it. So that made it look pretty safe. So we went to visit it. And it was not what we thought at all. The pottery was late, so it wasn't the right date. The checkpoint was gone, and so it was all rather wild and woolly. What we realized, or I realized later, was when you go through Henry Wright's survey, he didn't pay any attention to late sites, and so his map doesn't have them on it. And he was just using a compass, and so his locations weren't necessarily 100% accurate. And so 100 meters or so away, there was indeed a second millennium site. But the obvious mound was one that was not on his survey. And so when you're trying to work with the satellite imagery, and if he doesn't have all the mounds on there, then you get a little confused. So that's why we went wrong. So anyway, this wasn't going to work. And so we really needed the other one to work out. And it did. So it was a little bigger. It wasn't really tiny, but it was still pretty small. We could see very clearly in terms of the pottery that I've got circled in red. It seemed to have early second millennium pottery, so that looked good. And then on this brief wonder, Abdulmir Hamdani, who you see in the top left, who was a PhD student of ours, found a inscribed cone dated to Rim Sin. And so we were fine. We're in the right time period. It was a little odd that you had such literacy on a small site, but that certainly whetted our appetite rather than made us inclined to not do it. And so we requested a permit to work there, and we had one season worth of one Christmas season, so we worked there for about a month. On the surface, so looking at the satellite image on the surface, I thought I could see a big square structure with a few buildings on the outside. It all seemed very regular, and I still think it was once there, but we didn't find it. So anytime we dug there, we did not find this particular material. I think what happens in Mesopotamian sites is that the walls have more salt in them than the room fills. And so you wind up with white lines on the surface where walls used to be, but you have to dig that deep before you actually find anything that looks structurally like a mud brick wall. So you have these ghost walls, and so a lot of what you can see on the surface are probably ghosts of architecture that was once there that is now long gone. This was really clear, but it certainly wasn't there. But that didn't really bother us particularly. So we could live at Ur in this dig house. It was not a bad drive to go between Ur and Sakarya, so that all worked out really well. So the plan of work that we had as we went in, we wanted to do a surface survey of the site. We'd done that at Mashkan Shapur. We wanted to do something rather similar at Sakarya. We wanted to conduct a magnetic gradiometry survey so we could get an understanding of the architectural patterns there and do some exploratory excavations. And we did those. We didn't exactly come up with entirely what we expected. So the surface survey was fine. We walked up and down, not quite every inch of the site, but we covered it pretty firmly, and were able to recover a large number of, a fairly large number of objects, which gave us a sense of what was going on. What surprised us, however, was the fact that we found four inscribed things, stamped bricks, inscriptions. What are they doing in a site this size? It's not as though one runs into inscribed material on large sites with any on the surface of large sites with any particular regularity, and so that was something of a surprise. But we were quite happy with them, of course. And then we did our magnetometry survey. And normally, when you do a magnetometry survey, you walk up and down, and you wind up with a nice picture, which is going to show you where the architecture is. Whether the architecture is made out of mud brick, it's still going to should show up. If it's made out of baked brick, it should show up. If it's made out of stone, it should show up. And we found nothing. In fact, there was so little data in many cases that the software wouldn't even process it. There was so little contrast. So that was a disappointment and rather confused us. But we hadn't actually done magnetometry in Mesopotamia before, so maybe there was something special there. We weren't really quite certain. But we opened up some excavations to see what we would find there. And I just want to go through fairly quickly the series of excavations we did. Some of them so this was going across where we thought we could see some architecture, and this was also, this one was designed to link the two of them. And then these were exploring other architectural traces at the edge of the site so we can compare the center to the edge. And then we had a couple of little holes kind of around, which were mostly designed to figure out how big the site was. And, you know, this was a short Christmas season, so that, you know, we didn't have that much time to do it. So at the edge, the sloping levels, which I think you can see in the bulk here, sloping down, indicated that we were off the edge of the site. This is just material that has washed off the site. And so that allowed us to kind of get a bit of sense that perhaps the mound had originally been quite high and steep, and then now had eroded into the more gentle slope that it actually had. So that gave us one piece of information. Now, since we were the first foreign project to work in Iraq since all the wars and embargoes and things like that, we were joined by a number of Iraqi archaeologists who were extremely puzzled by the ability of these foreigners to come in and choose a site that had no architecture. They had never seen a site. These are professional archaeologists who spent their entire time lives digging in Iraq, who had always found walls whenever they dug. We weren't doing that. That was not happening here. And they thought it was very weird. What we found were basically clay platforms. And we even kind of drilled a hole at the bottom of one of them. But, you know, nothing that was actually architecture. Certainly somebody had put things here, but nothing that was actually could be really called architecture. Occasionally a little bit of paving with a couple of pots on it, kind of stuck in the middle of all of this clay. In one case, we had a drain. And that was kind of nice. Maybe a fish pond. We weren't quite sure. So what's happening here? If you map Sakarya in terms of the map, it plunks itself down quite happily where Salaberger shows the site of Gayesh. And Gayesh was the place where the Ur-3 kings would be crowned and was an important place for the Akitu festival. But that didn't necessarily mean that it had a whole lot of people living in it. I mean, it had to have a priestess living there, and it had to have a temple there, but it didn't necessarily have to have a lot of people living there. So we're beginning to think that perhaps what we were dealing with was, in fact, Gayesh, and that was one of the things we were thinking about. Now, for the Akitu festival, which is held in spring, which is a lovely time for camping in Iraq, you could have had a large number of people there just for the festival without necessarily having a whole lot of infrastructure for it. And we certainly had plenty of evidence for campsites at Sakarya. These, however, dated to a somewhat later time period. So camping is certainly was what was going on there. But even when we dug deep, we still didn't find anything like architecture, just what usually would look like campsites. To the extent that we found anything that looked like architecture, there would be various piles of baked bricks. A lot of these baked bricks would have stamps on them to show that there had been some royal construction somewhere, but they had been reused. So what's going on here? Now, at that time, it was generally understood that the southern cities were abandoned after the reign of Samsi-Iluna, whether it's his year 11 or 20 or 22 or 28 or whatever. Wherever you are within Samsi-Iluna, that there had been a major abandonment. And I was actually the first person to kind of propagate this idea. And you can see basically in, here we have Gosh and Armstrong who are working on the pottery. They're kind of showing the southern area as being abandoned at that particular point. But then that wasn't quite what we were finding. Now, Old Babylonian settlement continued further north. So around the area of Baghdad and north, certainly it continued, but you did not have it so much in central and southern Babylonia, as far as we can gather. What we now see, I think, is that this all works fine until you get to the far south when you actually had the Sealand dynasty. And so you had a Sealand occupation that took place in that far southern area. And the problem with that far southern area was that it hadn't really been surveyed very much. It now has been surveyed by Abdulmir Hamdani, and he's found lots of Sealand period sites. And so the Sealand as being an important political force in the perhaps mid-second millennium is now much more firmly established. But that was not the case when we were working at Sakarya, even though we clearly, in retrospect, were digging a Sealand period site. This is the kind of time period that we would be talking about, the period immediately after the defeat of Sun Siluna in his 11th year. So what did we find there? Very little in the way of terracottas. I mean, normally when you're kind of working in southern Mesopotamia, you have all kinds of clay figurines and animal figurines and plaques and this and that and the other. Well, this is all we got. So that's not much. That was not one of the things that they were really big on. On the other hand, what we found a lot of was stone. Now, there are no stones in southern Mesopotamia. You have to go for a long distance to get stones, but a lot of little grinding stones of one kind or another, we actually find a lot of them, which was a little bit surprising. That was fairly striking. The other thing we found were pierced sherds. Now, we were familiar with pierced sherds from working in Syria, these can be used as spindle whorls, so they can be used for spinning probably fairly coarse thread. But by and large, Mesopotamians were more sophisticated than that, would make nice little kind of conical spindle whorls out of stone, very nicely made, not anything quite as crummy as these. And so we're getting a whole bunch of artifacts that simply didn't feel Mesopotamian at all. Were much less sophisticated than what we really had thought. But we did get a certain amount of bits and pieces of bronze. They weren't without metal at all. Most of them pieces were pretty small. So it's not as though we had a lot of it. But they were also using stone. So we were finding stone tools all over the place. Under normal circumstances, you find stone tools in Neolithic sites, and once they've got bronze, they've got bronze, and they don't really mess around with chipstone tools, especially since the stone itself is not necessarily doesn't exist within the southern alluvium. So all of a sudden, we were finding all of these stone tools. We did find a certain amount of beads. That's not particularly surprising. That was fine, and that would be fairly common. One of the things we found, which I haven't seen before, are cowrie shells. And what I like about them is they were cut exactly the same way as these cowrie shells, which are being sold on Amazon for somebody who wants to make their own jewelry today. They're really identical in terms of the way they were treating it, so that they were getting cowrie shells from the Gulf, presumably, and then cutting them for jewelry. But we also found gold and silver. We didn't find gold and silver at Mashkan Shapir, for example. So that was rather unusual to be finding this material on the surface of the site. And we kept on finding bits and pieces of inscriptions. So I think it's really within this context that we become much more comfortable with the idea that we probably were digging Gaish. So those inscriptions would have been because it had this important temple, which we didn't happen to dig. The Karzida temple at Gaish was a starting point for the travel of the god Nana to Ur for the important Akitu festival. We had all of these, especially Ur III kings, who were clearly very interested in doing a certain amount of construction at Sakarya. It's just that we weren't finding the buildings. We were just finding people who had reused the bricks in later times. But I don't think that you would bring bricks from Ur to Sakarya for any particular good reason. So almost certainly there was important Ur III construction going on there. We did find a couple of tablets. nice Earth 3 tablet sitting in a much later goblet base. And this other one that was not nearly as nice. But clearly these were out of context. Certainly the Earth 3 one was out of context, but presumably came from the site at some time, and fairly typical of Earth 3 tablets had been baked. Now, we find lots of evidence of the use of Scirpus reed. So we probably had a lot of kind of reconstruction there. That was very common. And when we look at the animal bones, these are really much more consistent with the occupation of a marsh environment or marshes being nearby than the normal material which we get from the other sites. So instead of being heavily dominated by sheep and goat and pig, we have more cattle, fish, and various things like that. The fish are pretty much all carp, and we were able to kind of compare them to the carp that we were eating, and they were very similar. But the high proportion of cattle is very, very unusual. Normally, when you have southern Mesopotamian animal bones, you'll have a few cows that were presumably being used as oxen. They're generally pretty old. You don't have kind of large amounts of cattle being consumed, but that's not the case here. Here we can look at the fish and the shellfish, and those also were playing a fairly large role in the diet. And so we had a lot of kind of seafood there. So both cattle and sheep are kept by modern marsh Arabs. So here's a marsh settlement. Here's a calf happily eating a reed, so that the products of the marshes are going to be perfectly good. Both of these are shots from a tell that we went to visit that was being camped on by a group of marsh-adapted population. I think we're fairly comfortable with thinking of Sahariya as being at least close to a marsh and having access to that kind of material, but in a period that is going to be after the Earth 3. This is going to be later than Earth 3, so that's what we found at the top. The Earth 3 period, we would only find bits and pieces lower down. We found a certain number of burials there. These are going to be later. We found this baby in a jar and a couple of, adult child. Generally had pretty much nothing in the way of grave goods or much of anything like that. This poor guy only had a head and an arm bone, and I don't know what happened to the rest of him. But that was all we had. He did have a couple of pots, but he didn't have anything else. We also found a couple of kilns, so there was a certain amount of ceramic production going on there. So what's going on here? The site was clearly important at the end of the third and the beginning of the second millennium, but it also continued into the mid-second millennium when nearby Ur was abandoned. We were driving not very far to go from Ur to Sahariya and back every day, but Ur was definitely not occupied during that mid-second millennium time period, but Sahariya was. And so was it Gaish? Was it the place where the Ur three kings came to celebrate the Akitu festival during the autumn equinox? Were people camping there because they wanted to be part of the festival? Did lots of people go there for that? Did this festival continue after the Ur three period? These are all kind of questions that I don't know that we can answer. Or are we just looking at a marsh population? Does it have nothing to do with that? And you just have these, we have the cuneiform document from an earlier stage in its occupation. And I think that's more likely. Now, Abdulmir Hamdani has identified a large number of ancient marsh-adapted sites. And so we're now getting a much better understanding of the ways in which the southern marshes were exploited, not just today, but were exploited in the past. And so Sahariya, I think, has to be seen in its later manifestation. So not when it was Gaiash, but most of the stuff that we were digging at the top was probably a marsh-adapted site in a time period when you had much less irrigated agriculture further north, and you probably had much more water coming south and larger marshes in the south under those circumstances. So we kind of think that that's kind of where we are there. The faunal remains, if you remember, had more cattle than is usual in Mesopotamia, but that's what we saw when we went to the marshes. Was a lot of cattle. You don't see cattle elsewhere, but we did see cattle when we visited the Marsh settlement. And we found plenty of fish and bird bones. So it's always hard to know. The problem is it's very difficult to compare what we have in terms of fish and bird bones with most of the other faunal reports, because you have to be doing a lot of flotation to get the fish and bird bones, and if you're not doing flotation, you're not going to recover them. So partly we're finding them because we're doing a lot of fine sieving, but if you're not doing fine sieving, you're not going to see any fish and bird bones. So knowing exactly where we are, but that again would be something that would be consistent with marsh dwellers. But it's also possible that certainly for some of its time it would have been occupied by pastoral nomads. That's another possibility. They're certainly around herding their sheep. So that's something else we need to bear in mind. Or was it all of the above? The Akitu festival is celebrated at Gaiash during the equinox, as I've said, a perfect time for camping. And so all kinds of people may have been kind of passing through and settling there. And the question is, to what extent would it have maintained its religious importance after the Ur-3 period, or did it just kind of become something completely different? Was it like Glastonbury, a place where everybody would go for a brief period of time and go away again? That certainly in many ways was what we were excavating in terms of lots of little fireplaces and things like that, and very little in the way of architecture. Let me try to draw a couple of conclusions. So I want to go back to the beginning first in terms of looting. I think that the looting holes tend to be in the upper levels where mud brick preservation is poor. So I don't know that most of the looting is really destroying that much of the archaeological record. What it does do is it destroys our ability to see that archaeological record from the surface. That is, the surface is all messed up. When the surface isn't messed up, we can see where the walls used to be, even if you can't excavate them there. And then the other thing is that when they're going after cuneiform tablets, then they're going to be digging deeper, because cuneiform tablets don't preserve in this upper level, and you have to go deeper to get them. And that's when I think you begin to get the deeper looting. In terms of Sahariya, I think we need to, and I think people are, building into our models of Mesopotamia not just everybody living in mud brick settlements and permanent settlements, but there being much more kind of flexibility. People can be living in reed huts, they can be living in tents, they can go back and forth between them, they can move around, and that's something that we need to use in terms of the way that we think about Mesopotamia. And that's it.